We're spending the week worrying about this 10 or 12 line quotation, and on Monday we talked about culture. Today we're going to talk about the church. I'll say a few irrelevant things again at the beginning while the group gathers. Some were at the Village Center and some here. I think Arndt proved his own point very well at the end of the day when he said he's not much of a measurer, because he announced it was 9 o'clock when it was 9:17. They told me when I came to Holden I'd have to turn off my little motor and my self-adjusting punctuality mechanism, and I'll be glad to do that.
Well, I just turned my clock back to the 9 o'clock.
Oh, I see.
You
just
turned the 9 o'clock
ahead. That's not a battery.
Like the town where in the olden days when they had the telephone operator called Central. Only Roland Bainton and I are old enough to remember, I suppose. But he said the other night that he remembered those telephones. The little town where the guy would phone in around noon every day and ask what time it was. Remember the operators did that as a pre-service? And he would say, well, it's 7 minutes to 12 or whatever. And this went on, and the town clock kept getting further and further off until they finally discovered that it was the town clock setter who was calling in every day to her to find out what time it was. She was reading the time from his clock, which is a good illustration of relativity. It is no less relevant than Arndt Halvorsen's story of the last hour. He has two chickens and I have two timekeepers. One other irrelevant thing, I suppose. I'd like to spend just a moment setting the mood, because we're going to talk about the church. And that's a strange subject, and I want to be sure we have the mood right. What I'm not going to spend time on today is attacking the institution. I've thought in my 4 days here at Holden, which makes me part of the veteran generation by now, there are only three institutions or social forces that I've heard anybody put in a good word for these days. I haven't yet heard a good word for educational establishment, business establishment, military establishment, religious establishment, political establishment, or any other. I've heard a few good words, mainly from Will, about the black race. I haven't heard any good one yet about the white. I've heard a few from me that were good about the younger generation. I haven't heard any good ones from the younger generation about the younger generation. I've heard a few good things about Holden Village, but probably mainly not from Carol Hinderley, who keeps reminding us of its fault. I didn't eavesdrop on the staff meeting, so I didn't really find out how things are going. But in general, it's in the nature of things these days and these years that when we get together, we knock and we let institutions fall apart under our eyes and we see them disintegrating. Now, it could be that we do this because we're just the wrong people. Got a bunch of negativists up here to speak and listen and talk this week. Or the wrong people speak up. Or somehow we set the wrong mood and we get off on the wrong path. Or it's a good way to evade ourselves. If you knock all the institutions, you don't have to examine yourself and find out whether you're part of the problem. Or it could be because we think it's more profound to do this than to do something else. It isn't. It isn't very hard at all. My first book was an attack on the religious institution, and it's the only one I've done in that line, and it was the easiest one I've ever written. You don't have to be very profound to do it. I have a little slogan on my office wall that pretty well summarizes that whole case, and if I get that on the table or the hearth for today, then we don't have to worry about that anymore. It shows also how conservative I am, because in an era when the neo-Orthodox have been quoting Snoopy and Peanuts in his crowd, I'm still back there with Pogo. Some of us believe in cherishing the old values. Pogo once said, "We have faults we haven't even used yet." And that's my office wall motto. So if we'd want to spend the morning on it, believe me, if you want to know what's wrong with the church, I think I probably have a longer mimeograph list than anybody else in the room. and write me and I'll send you that. This doesn't happen to be the topic today. Rather, I want to deal with the disintegration of the religious institution in terms more of inevitable agony rather than malevolent holding on to some bad old things. I think I can do that best with a little diagram from which I've devised from Thomas Luckman's book, The Invisible Religion. And that's why I'm sitting here today. I have a blackboard, and because people said that those windows and those are harder to look at than these. So if you want to look out windows, you can look past me with comfort today. Since I have this real hard diagram to make, in the middle, I, religious institution, the church, for example. The second concentric, for those of you who can't see, is SC, Sacred Cosmos. I'll tell you about that in just a moment. And the outer one, WV, Worldview. This week we're talking about worldview. Today we want to relate this to this. The other day we talked about worldviews and said this is the mentally furnished apartment in which so many people in a culture and in an epoch live that it seems to be universal. An earlier worldview that found the world at the center and the stars as punctured holes in a black bowl is not a way we can think, even if we want to think. And if we ever act as if the act of becoming a Christian means that first you have to adopt the biblical worldview. I think there are about 200 biblical worldviews, but all those things those stupid people used to think about where the stars were. Read Job 38 and 39 and you'll find out they weren't so stupid. But if you think that converting somebody means to get them inside that worldview first, you're in real trouble. You cannot. The cause and effect relations are just going to be different. And a lot of us feel real guilty because we can't fit inside such a worldview. It seems to me the text that Carol Hinderly read to those of us really virtuous and righteous ones who got up early enough this morning for the first shift of breakfast. From Galatians, it'll be the epistle in Vespers tomorrow night. Now that you know God or that you're known by Him, why do you want to go back to all those weak and beggarly elements? The stars and the signs and so on. Stoicheia. I like to read it that way. Why do you want to go back to an earlier worldview? You can't. You just aren't going to be able to transport yourself. You can fake it. You can have 11 to 11:59 on Sunday morning. You can step from one thing into another and think you become virtuous by doing so. But it seems to me that the Bible is constantly in the business of shucking off worldviews and trying to get people to live where they live. So this mentally furnished apartment, I'm trying to say, we are moving into a new one. We're sort of in the hall. Lease ran out on the old and we haven't found what we're after yet. But our cause and effect relations are just that way. I'll give you a good recent example. Again, I'm a historian. Recent, 1859. if Bacon can show that Erasmus and Luther are part of our present revolution, then 1859 is like the morning paper. Darwin. A lot of people in the church fight or fought Darwin. They fought him on what it would do to the first few chapters of Genesis. Well, I got enough trouble. I'm not going to import that issue this morning. But what interests me is that in general, the people in America and England who fought Darwin hardest on the first few chapters of Genesis bought him the most on most of the other areas of life. Survival of the fittest in their economic theories, and so on. I went to a Missouri Synod Lutheran prep school, which is the most Darwinian place you ever could have been. First of all, survival in the dormitories. We lived Darwin. It was a jungle. but economics classroom, education classroom, all over, except when you got in the religion classroom, there you could sort of put him in a box and put away. What I'm saying is we all moved into something of the Darwinian worldview. In the once upon a time, people did believe that the world, most people did believe the world was sort of static and things stayed in little boxes. And today, just by nature, every one of us is in flux, development, and so on. You don't have to buy all the creed of Darwin or the Darwinians. It wasn't his fault. You don't have to know all the outcomes of history that these people profess to know. But to know that to be in history is to be in flux, we are to history as a fish is to water, was a worldview you just could not acquire. stay positive, you just acquired it. Okay, so a lot of that is around with us yet. This is what we meant by worldview. And I said there's always a kind of a mythic dimension to it. When the Darwinian thing came on the scene and his prophets, Thomas Huxley and Herbert Spencer, ran around telling everybody this was the ultimate truth, they didn't realize that someday we could look back on them and say they too had their myth. And I'm sure that we're going to be living with our own myths in our own times. Mentally furnished apartment. The sacred, this is what we're trying to find out where we're going. The sacred cosmos is what people do with it when they want to find out its meaning. Worldview is automatic. Sacred cosmos, you start working with it. Sacred cosmos is what I would say is the real religion of people. What people really believe. This might be the flag, love it or leave it, is the real religion of a lot of people right now. I saw that on more back windows of cars on the way out here. Love it or leave it. That's the real religion of a lot of people. Sex is the real religion of a lot of people. I think the real religion of a lot of people is best exemplified. This might be my own secret one. I might as well. I've got faults I haven't even used yet. Halftime at a Southern football game. Cotton Bowl. Southern Baptist minister has the invocation, and then these guys bloody each other for a half an hour, and then they get the priestesses to march, and there's a big liturgy, and Baal is out there. It's kind of a controlling of violence and so on. In Chicago, I can't go to a Bears game because I'm not in somebody's will. To pass on bear season passes through people's wills. Now, to do that, it has to be a kind of a religion, and we know that, and we better have a little distance on it so we can smile at it. I feel a kind of religious awe, I'll confess it, at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier or Lincoln Memorial, something like I feel when I go to a medieval cathedral. There are certain symbols that move us this way. Think of, sounds funny to say, whenever we have an assassination in America, it's getting to be routine in the 60s, the major assassinations at least, the three Ks. Have you noticed in each case we have always a funeral that belongs to the religious institution? Cardinal Cushing and, the Long Jack. Or the Baptist funeral of Martin Luther King. And we also have a public, everybody's religion symbol. I always wonder, is there a liturgist in the basement of the Capitol building waiting for the next assassination? How did they know a few hours later how to do all this? And yet, as they did it, I found it very important to do it. I think we sat glued. It's the only time I've ever gotten gangrene in front of a television set. That whole weekend, we needed it. We had to go through it. The Catholic Mass didn't unite us all, and yet this riderless horse and some of these other symbols help it. So I'm not just knocking this sacred cosmos bit. It has its ugly side. In its name we fight holy wars, and it has its beautiful side. In its name we inspire each other to some sacrifice. And then in the middle of it all is what most people mean when they talk about religion. Now I'm saying all this stuff out here, Darwinian worldview, Copernican worldview, we'll call it whatever you've got, has a religious dimension. But it's an automatic one. The sacred cosmos has a religious dimension, but it's an acquired one. We pick and choose. We decide something. Some of these symbols are given to us, some of them we can reject. And then religious institution, that's in the modern world an entirely voluntary thing. This is what most people mean by religion, and yet it's very little bit of all the religion that goes on. This is the religion, in other words, that is in the control of the priests. It is the one that builds buildings. It's the one that asks for our allegiance. It's the one that formally organizes these realities. Now, in Thomas Luckman's interpretation, and I would agree with him, this is the one that is in trouble. I call today's thing the crunch in the churches. From Hannah Arendt's quotation, the loss of worldly permanence and reliability has hit all kinds of institutions, which in the past were unquestioned. Today they're in trouble. In the past, the king was just a given. The state was a given. The virtue of your race was a given. Your class in life was a given. Today, if we want to affirm any of them, it's a hard-won affirmation. You have to examine it first. It's all in trouble. The worldly permanence and reliability, which in earlier worldviews people thought just went on forever, and you just related to settled institutions in the modern world and in our world is disintegrating. Thus, in an earlier world, you didn't choose to join a religious institution or not. From 313 A.D., Edict of Milan era, to 1776, etc., early USA, for 14 centuries, if you lived in the Western world, it was culturally and socially impossible not to be Christian. You have two circles, sacred cosmos and religious institution, all one thing. And no matter what you had in your mind, you went to the priests. If you were sick, you went to the witch doctor, or it was the priest who prevented medical research. Priest, I'm not fighting priest, religious institution. Today we go to surgeons who, as I say, the better ones tell us they're not much up above that, but they're a little better. You want to know about the future. In the old days, you went to the priest and he cut open a chicken and read, two chickens and read the entrails, compared them, and told you what was going to happen tomorrow. Today you turn on TV and watch the weatherman, who is scientific, you know, about 0.0008% more accurate than the entrail reader. But it is a little step this way. My summary quotation for this, I used to quote him a great deal, but then he became establishment philosopher and I'm reluctant to anymore. Eric Hoffer says, at some point in history, God and the priests seemed to become superfluous, but the world kept going on anyhow. He didn't say God is dead. He didn't say they were superfluous, but legislatures came out roughly the same way, whether or not God and the priests exist. In the U.S. Senate, we have a chaplain. You ever visit the Senate? You get invited. They'll ship you all the way from Seattle to Washington for a two-minute prayer. Nobody's there. And nobody listens if they are there. And nobody pays any attention. In fact, the rules of the Senate forbid the prayer to have anything to do with what the Senate's talking about. I learned painfully. I wrote a nasty column recently blaming the current Senate chaplain for the rule, and turns out that it was the Senate's own rule which made it all the worse. All right, doesn't make any difference whether you have that invocation or benediction. People are going to vote their politics, they're going to vote their interests, they're going to pork their barrels and roll their logs and do that. Same way whether or not God and the priests exist, whereas we at least picture in an earlier worldview, you know, God will strike you dead. You better come through, do it right, etc. So in the modern worldview, in the modern world, you are free to take on life with this institution or not. It's voluntary. And it's going to suffer because of this general loss of worldly permanence and reliability. Well, this is one we're going to concentrate on the rest of the time this morning and see what it does. Before I go on from there, though, I want to be sure we all know what we're talking about in these zones. And this is a good moment to take a five-minute break from my manic babble to see whether you caught on the other day or whether we're talking about the same things. Do you have a fairly clear picture what we mean by these three now? You want to throw something in? Institutions you join or don't join. Sacred cosmos, some symbols are given to you, others you can reject, but in general the whole society does its religious thing that way. Worldview you can't really reject. You can cross your fingers, you can try to acquire a little distance on it, but somehow it's your 2 + 2 = 4 world. It's just your given environment. And I'm saying all three of these have a religious dimension. Yes?
You're not saying that everybody has the same worldview.
No. I think I'm a real pluralist here. I think there's a lot of varieties of style within this. So I don't define it in very narrow terms. But I think an easy way to see the how you can tell what a worldview is to see someone who is deliberately totally rejecting it. For example, Apollo 11 mission, these guys that have to talk 72 hours in a row come up with all kinds of interesting things in the end. You learn the bathroom habits of every astronaut. I mean, Cronkite knows all this. And they will always report on something. The Flat Earth Society will come out with a new little bulletin saying that in what way the Flat Earth Society can live anyhow. Well, they wouldn't dare attack the Catholic Church or the Republican Party or something that way. When they tell that story, they can assume that virtually everyone in the audience is going to laugh or smile. because our worldview is past the flat earth, and we can say those people are making heroic attempts to stand against it. But they're kind of dropouts. But now, in line of what you're saying, within worldview, there are just tremendous differences in lifestyle, to coin a phrase, in the freedom we have not to go along with it. There are a lot of people, for example, today who whose worldview and sacred cosmos is Teilhardian, named after Teilhard de Chardin, the Catholic priest who fused an evolutionary and a Christian vision. And I'm often in the company of people who, in effect, say, you're not with it if you don't share that worldview. Well, I said before, you can't jump out of it all the way, and I find a lot of things to admire in that vision, but I'm fighting it, too. I'm a dropout, if that's what it is. Teilhard de Chardin treated World War II in a footnote and saw something in Hiroshima and Nagasaki positive in human development. Well, bluey for him. I'm that kind of personalist existentialist that wants to talk about each person in Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and so on. So,
hallelujah.
I'm going to stand, you know, against this attempt to force on me a phase of a worldview that I... A worldview is not only a determinist relentless force. It is acquired because it accounts for more facts than any other model. I guess that'd be the best way to put it. And our worldview is in trouble today because the ones we've got don't account for enough of the facts in front of us. So let's not make our worldview such a narrow thing, but you can talk in these grand terms, you can see we've moved past certain problems. Yes?
Will?
Sort of giveaway that the third world people's work. We're also watching television. That happened also with not the moon one, but another Apollo one. If you remember, this is the greatest voyage since Magellan, and he was eaten by cannibals on some island. Remember that?
Yeah.
And of course, I think it was something like 10 minutes later. There were some apologies for that particular view.
I recall the gaffe came. People noticed it mainly because Cronkite or somebody said he'll get the biggest reception since Magellan.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, anybody that has to go through a ticker tape parade in Mayor Daly City goes through something fairly equivalent to that. Let's see, I have some notes. Religious institutions now, I'm not going to knock them today. We're going to try to understand their crunch, their agony. Define church. Church is the people of God. Not all of whom are always a real big part of this thing, but they're all somehow related to it. My own doctrine of the church is not an elitist one. I've coined a technical sociological phrase for that entity to which everything like underground churches and remnants and creative things have to relate. This is the term, I may have to spell it because it's such a technical thing. Great, big, messy church. That's my definition. That is, people who call themselves Christian, who want to be, who are half faithless, who are, you know, they're all kinds of things. They're not our club, they're not our crowd, are as much a part of it as our club and our crowd. People called by the name of Christ. People who in whom somehow the Spirit of God is active, or they'd like him to be, or he wants to be. That's what we're talking about today. That might be 900 million people, it might be 9 people. We don't know the borders of it, but we know the marks of it. One, holy, Catholic, apostolic, that's church. Now, that church is always in the hands of people in their own generation, people with worldviews and sacred cosmoses and institutions to run and so on. The church is in terrible trouble today. The institutional church, the church, and any way you want to talk about it. I suppose that's kind of a compliment to it. If it weren't in trouble, it would be living a flat earth society kind of world. That is, we are in trouble because we are more in the world than we used to be. We are more vulnerable. We are more exposed. I'm not saying we chose that exposed life. We may have done everything we could to build the walls thicker and bigger a little longer. But there's been too much seepage. Television pipes in other world views and other value systems. kids go off to college and bump into non-ALC Lutherans here and there. Men go off to a war and see other parts of the world. We just couldn't keep the walls, and so somewhere along the line we began to make a virtue of that necessity and say, since we can't keep the walls, let's not keep the walls. Let's see what it would be like. The walls, symbols of worldly permanence and reliability. You used to build churches with as thick walls as possible, fortresses and so on. Today, if we build at all, and I'm not sure we're going to do as much building in the future as in the past, we build airier, lighter, tent-like kinds of things. And where we don't, we're in trouble. So the wall as the symbol, beginning to break down. We are exposed, and yet we have a certain hope for it. Another part of my definition of the church, the people of God, is it is a community of hope. People often ask, why don't you quit the church? Well, can you quit the church? Not at will, definitely. You can quit going to church, but you can't quit the church. If somehow the Spirit of Christ is formed in you, you've just got a responsibility to some other people, and you're in it. But I never judge anybody who, quote, quits. But I have to say, if you use the definition of community of hope, you have to ask at what moment. Hans Küng, the German Catholic theologian, says, if you know, if you really know the outcome of history, if you know that it is a hopeless community in every dimension, integrity says, get out. If it is a community of hope, then you somehow relate to it. You can be critical, you can be impatient, you can be restless, whatever you are, you're a part of it. This is because the sign of the Spirit, coming to us from the future, as it were, says this body of people is to be a bearer of hope in the world. We expect something of it. It's another good compliment to the church. G.K. Chesterton once said, that's how I start a lot of my stories, because whether he said them or not, he would have said them. Whenever I don't know what to do with it, I do it. G.K. Chesterton, as C.S. Lewis once said. The Bible. It'll be one of those three. I'm pretty sure of Chesterton on this one. Chesterton says that when you see a man in his 12th scotch reeling and throwing away everything and ruining his family and so on, you pick him up and you jostle him and you say, come on, be a man. When you see an alligator reaching for its third missionary's wife, you don't say, come on, be an alligator. we have a certain assumption of what we're going to expect of these things. Now, last week I was driving across North Dakota, and I kept hearing on the news that the Eagle, pardon me if there are any eagles fluttering around here, the Eagle, the fraternal order, had a big convention out west, and they voted to keep their restrictive clause. Who'd want to be? Why don't you guys march on them one?
Eagles are much, much bigger than crows.
All right. We're angry and we're frustrated and we're outraged by the church for not being the church. But I drove along, I just kept thinking, be an eagle. You are eagles. That's what that's for. That was a club designed to get like-minded people to keep other people out. The church looks an awful lot like Eagles Club, doesn't it? But it isn't supposed to. It's a community of hope that says we have a different norm coming to us from the future. We better start living into it. So I'm speaking of the church in that kind of context. Now, the church is in the crunch. It has to make a decision along the way. I was trying to show earlier by my reference to K.R. Desjardins that you don't have to be gullible about what people come along and tell you is the new worldview you've got to accept. The other day we threw past McLuhan and Maharishi and Marcuse and all and said, there are a lot of advocates who say that's the only thing the future is going to be. Well, take it very, very seriously, but not too seriously. Fingers crossed. You can withhold consent from drift of history. But if you want to be a participant in history, you have to decide when, quote, everything is up for grabs, to reach, get your oar into it, or something like that. And I think that at a moment such as this, when we have this protean world that Hannah Arendt talks about, when everything can become almost anything else at almost any moment, It's somewhere in the middle of this, the people who want to represent this community of hope get in there with their symbols, their affirmations, their hopes, last night's term, Treadway, their clues. What happens if you don't? The next one I overuse, and I'm sure it's Chesterton, he says, if you want a white fence post to be white, you're going to be very busy. You don't let it alone, right? Those of you who are against change in the church are going to be very busy in the future. Most people think to be conservative is to let something alone. Chesterton says, look at that fence post after a little while. And he wrote this in, you know, pre-industrial pollution, England in the 1920s. Dogs, weeds, erosion, air, rot, moth, rust, duck, corrupt. You're going to be out there painting that post every once in a while. You're going to be taking care of it. All right. So whether you want to be conservative or liberal, and in my world this isn't even a very important distinction. I have a much simpler world. Good guys and bad guys. I know an awful lot of good guys, conservatives and liberals, and I know an awful lot of bad guys, conservatives and liberals. So that today we're not going to talk about it in those terms. As a historian, I think there's so much power in the past that I'm, in one way, a conservative. I don't know where else to get any revolutionary power to change for the future. Most potent symbols we've got are some very old ones. We have trouble with some very recent past symbols. So let's not worry about conservative or liberal. Let's talk about change or non-change. And let's assume that change is going on all the time. If you think you've just let that old white post there, no, the church as we knew it, the good old days, the way it was before everybody started messing with it. If you're a revolutionary or radical, don't worry at all about people of that mentality. That old post will rot and be gone. Don't worry about them at all. I've coined a little dual maxim on this. Edmund Burke, who is probably the most intelligent conservative of the modern world, and if you're not a conservative but want to read just one, read Edmund Burke, once said, if it is not necessary to change, it is necessary not to change. Think about that. Or if there is a value you're so sure of, conserving, then you better mount all you've got to hold it no matter what else happens. That's the flat earth people are doing that. And a lot of people who are making bigger contributions to humanity may very well be doing that. If it is not necessary to change, it is necessary not to change, he says. Well, I flip that around and say, if it is necessary to change, it is necessary to change. Or if you want to throw in an adverb, really. If it is necessary to change, it is really necessary to change. That is, not to subject yourself to mere drift. I think this is where the church got itself in trouble for several centuries. What did we do? We held out as long as we could on something. There'd be a new scientific discovery. And we'd say, oh, those atheistic scientists, they're really creating trouble for us. The Bible says, and we'd fight them, and we'd fight them, and we'd fight them, and we'd fight them. Until nobody believed the Bible said that anymore, and then we'd say, well, really, all along we really meant that, and so on. Think of everything that's happened to you. Well, somewhere along the line, wouldn't it be better, if it's necessary not to change, it is, you know, it's not necessary to change, it's necessary not to change. You know, if the book is at stake, all right, fight for it that way. But what was at stake, the book or some theory we had about it? So maybe it's better somewhere along the line to get there before a scientist did, have a theology big enough so that when he gets there we can say, well, welcome, you know, it's free atmosphere, we've been waiting for you. There are some people who have noticed a little reversal in this respect. For three centuries, the scientist had to be the controller against priestly power in the modern world. It was the priest who wanted to impose an orthodoxy and a narrowness on the world. And the scientist was God's liberator who said, clear out, guys, that's not true. There's some people today who fight certain kinds of technological rationality who are going to the priest again and saying to the scientist, don't put artificial limits on what might be true. Now, where are they going to find priests? Religious institutions are in trouble. They go all over for them. Maharishi, your guru, Pot, Zen, Jesus, all kinds of symbols. I recently ran through the alphabet, this is a secular society, of the current live options. You can go, you know, astrology, Bodo Tadol, it's a Buddhist text, it's about the biggest thing on our campus. The Kabbalah, see, I could just go right down the list too. I had a cheat on X, but I found one. Yoga and Zen. I mean, there's somebody believing in all of these things. What are they doing through all of this? They're trying to say, what Ian Forster said once, let's try to keep some breathing holes for the human spirit going. Now, I'm not a two cultures man. I'm not saying the scientists were the bad guys and the humanists the good guys. Too much of the time it had to be the other way around. But I am saying that there are people in the scientific and humanist communities who realize that if they become priestly, there won't be any breathing holes for the human spirit. So you bring religion in from the other side and say, let's blow it open. All right, if it is necessary to change, it is really necessary to change. You have to be there first. It is the initiator in history, the inaugurator, the one who sets the terms that makes history. This is why I've never been able to share the cult of relevance. I haven't purged it from my vocabulary, so now and then you have to use the word relevant. The daughter of the president always on TV says relevant, and that'll do as well to remind us. Whenever somebody says the church should be relevant to something or other, I can only say, too late, buddy, you're out of that game. What does it mean? To become relevant. Okay, come back to that. To become relevant means you run around all kinds of people who've got it made, and you tap them on the shoulder and say, hey, buddy, notice me. I've got a little something you don't have. He's got it made. He doesn't need to notice you. Get him when he's nervous. Get him when he doesn't yet know. Get him when he's looking for freedom. Give him a greater freedom. That's what has to happen. So if it is necessary to change, it's necessary really to change. That leads me then into running through my little four categories of the other day and asking, could it be that there's certain opportunity for the world, for the people of God, for the community of hope, in the loss of the worldly permanence and reliability of the church? Hannah Arendt, in the quotation here, isn't talking only about church, she's talking about political authority and others. But the first line of her second paragraph, the loss of worldly permanence and reliability is the big thing that's been happening to the church. Was the old worldly permanence and reliability all that good for God and man? Those simple little catechism answers that cut off the questions. I'm not so sure. They didn't always help people very much. You can find this all the way back as far as the fourth gospel already. I think I have a perfect illustration there. Remember the little story after Lazarus stinketh and Jesus is talking to his sister? I'm going to reassure her. I made a lot of pastoral calls at such a moment. I know what it's like. The temptation is to reach for the little black book and read them three texts and go on your way. Whereas you should just hold her hand for a few nights and days and pour coffee and sit there and listen and all that. Well, that's the mood Jesus was in. He wanted to be available to her. Bill Coffin tells me about a friend of his who is a Birchite and listens to a very radical preacher. And Coffin asked him, how do you put up with this? And he said, listen, the last 24 hours my wife was alive, he held her hand. And the first 24 hours after she was dead, he held my hand. He could read the yellow pages and I'd be there. Jesus wanted to be that to her. And so he said, well, now, you have a hope, don't you? Yes, Catechism answer 103B. Yes, I know that Latter-day Evil Rise. What did Jesus say? Catechism 100%. Life 0. It didn't do any bit of good. I am the resurrection of life. It's a new reality here. Okay, so we're always trying to lock it up in a book. Worldly permanence or liability. A lot of people shook up today that the church is a little less sure of itself. Think how much trouble we got people into by being too sure of ourselves. So, maybe there's a little gain in that. Maybe the fact that we're going to have to wrestle with a new worldview might be the best possible moment for us to look at what all we've got. Turn the plank over. See what is around under there. This is not to say there are no values in older formulations. I've got them creeping all over me, and I defend all kinds of them. but I'm not going to defend them because somebody once said them. I'm going to explore them to see what in it will enhance the life of the people of God and the people of the whole world of which they're a part. So let's look at the four. I've already implied the first. The other day, for those of you who came in late, we talked about four directions in which we saw cultural breakup of permanence and reliability. The first of these was authority. Is it all a loss or all a gain? I imagine we have a very mixed thing. Catholicism today is losing its authority. Is this also bad? It can't be done without suffering. Boy, all you have to do is rattle around an old convent these days and see people whose whole life is bent in one direction and everything clobbers in on them. Bishop Shannon got married, Rosemary tells me this morning, and one more symbol of decline of worldly, a married bishop, the loss of worldly permanence. Used to be, you never heard if somebody ever slunk away from a convent or left the priesthood or something like that. Somebody cracked a whip and you stayed in line or you went to hell. Now, we're in a world where maybe that isn't how it ought to be. Tremendous pain. You can't get out of one of these into another. This isn't just bad people. Again, there's a lot of agony in it, not necessarily malice. But if it is necessary to change, it is really necessary to change. There are a lot of people in the Roman Catholic Church today who are saying, let's look a different way for authority. Some of you may know Tillich's terms. Just as the other day I used Bella and Chong once, I'm going to use some big bad words today. Heteronymous and autonomous and theonymous. I'm getting tired of writing them, so I'll quit that. Nomos is a law. Auto is yourself. Automation, automatic, autonomous individuality. Now you're doing it from within. Heteronymous, you impose it. It's the outsider. It's the other coming in on you. Theonymous, transparent to God. Now look how much Catholic authority was heteronymous. That is, and that's what's happening today. In the middle of the breakup of worldly permanence and change, reliability, what's happening? You crack the whip. The Synod of Bishops this fall will say, come on, you guys, toe the line. Will they toe the line because of it? In the modern world, freedom, and I hope Christ's freedom, isn't going to work that way. That's heteronymous authority. In the modern world, authority makes its way through persuasion and not coercion in a voluntary society like the Church. Sure, a nation, a political society, can be heteronymous. You don't have to believe in the nation's laws to have them clobber you with them. But in the Church, you can slink away if you don't like them. Theonymous. You have to be convinced of them. Wasn't that easy? I talked about the Catholics. Isn't the same thing going on all over in the Church today? Hannah Arendt says, the loss of the fear of hell is the great movement of change in the modern political world. The king died. Is that true in the Church, too? Loss of the fear of hell. You can't kid me. You haven't heard a lot of sermons lately being very literal about this. You've got your hells, and I do, too. But it's a different way of looking at what hell is. And as soon as we got away from this little transactional view, whenever it comes back, I really tremble. I keep thinking, is that what God had in mind? Not long ago I had a phone call from some people saying, we have a friend in the University of Chicago Clinics who just took part in a seminar on death and dying. He has terminal cancer. He's the kind of man who asks himself, since I must die, of what use can I be to somebody? So he volunteered to be interviewed in this seminar in which a Jewish woman psychiatrist asked him some questions about his hope. A friend who got to hear the tape, these are usually anonymous, but because the family was putting on so much pressure, we were free to have one friend listen to it, said, you've never heard such beautiful Christian witness. But the family comes to me and says, can you get him out of that? We're going to sue the hospital if they go through with it. We're not sure he's in his right mind anymore. And as they talked, it started coming to me, here's what they had a view. They had a view that God's grace is like a faucet that turns on and off. We played a little game with you, that last minute ticket just before you die. What are they afraid of? That Jewish woman psychiatrist might throw him a little curve in which he wouldn't give the right catechism answer and God would damn him to hell. And here comes back, and I thought, well, they got out of the same books that I was brought up on. They didn't make that up. Somebody told them. I'm awfully guilty for being a part of that view. Isn't his problem? He is so full of hope and life. You go to minister to him and he ministers to you. So it's happening with us too. Why do you love God? I was on television one Christmas Eve a couple years ago with a fundamentalist Church of Christ missionary from Vietnam. I guess we agreed on almost nothing except that it was Christmas. Because we got to talking, I was admiring his sacrifice, I was glad he was doing all these things, and then he had me typed, and he wasn't glad that I was glad for him, because I was the wrong kind of motive for what he was doing. So I said, what is your motive? Get people away from the fires of hell. That's the worst motive anywhere for loving God. So I told a little parable from the Strasbourg mystic of the Middle Ages of the guy who sees a lady in a dream, she's carrying a torch and a pitcher. What are they for? The torch to burn the pleasures of heaven and the water to quench the fires of hell so people could start loving God for his own sake. Isn't that what the Bible's about? Okay, so the decline of the fear of hell, the fact that we can't manipulate this transaction the way we used to, has meant that people, if they come to church, might just be coming for the love of God, some of them. Be a little careful before we know just which of them are. They might just be coming because they love other people. They're not just coming to save their own hide later on. All right, what have we lost? Some people say you've lost an inerrant, infallible Bible. Think about this. Whenever I hear this debated in the Lutheran Church too, and I yield to none in my view of the authority of the Bible, but I don't like the inerrancy, infallibility game. Did you ever think of this? Do the people who accept inerrant, infallible Bible agree on doctrines any more than the people who don't? There are many sects on each side. Jehovah Witnesses believe in the inerrancy of the Bible, and they do a much better job of it than any Lutheran I've ever met. We skip around. Revelation, don't be literal. Daniel, don't be literal. Matthew, be literal. I don't know what you gain by that. I mean, the authority of the Bible comes to us because Christ is there and he is it, and then it derives from it. So let them fight. Seventh-day Adventists, Jehovah's Witnesses, and some kinds of Lutherans, all saying that if you had an inerrant Bible, you accept their view of it, then you'd all agree. We could fake it for a while before we learned that there were other kinds. Modern media, modern mobility have shown us this. You didn't used to know it. You could live in a valley of all Swedes or all Poles or something like that, and you never knew that other people had an inerrant Bible disagreed with you. All right, so that's the question of the tradition. So what I've been saying with authority is the loss of worldly permanence and authority, and these formulations are worldly, may be a gain at a time when in the world we are looking for how is God speaking to us, including through the Bible, through the Christian community. The second I can take very quickly, because it's so easy, the loss of the worldly permanence and reliability of the expert. Somebody here, you in the maroon shirt, said last night as we walked up, it was kind of reassuring to see how theologians disagreed with each other. The great experts, we're supposed to know the Christian lifestyle, and there were six pros around here, and there were six different opinions and so on. Once upon a time, people wouldn't have said it's kind of refreshing. My faith will go. Well, who says a theologian has to be right? He may be a lot darn a lot of other people about God. It's his business to look at it from a certain angle, but that doesn't mean that he's got it made. I used to hear of Adolf Harnack, perhaps the greatest modern church historian, who used to say that his sweeper, his housekeeper, the person who swept up his office, knew a good deal more about God and Jesus than he, the greatest scholar of his time, did. And that's one of those typical stories they have to tell to sound humble. So I started reading him and finding out that his theology committed him to it, and it was true. This is what Harnack was for in the world. He was really trying to tell us this is something of what Jesus is all about in the world. Now, he bollocks up a lot of things. I'm not here just to defend him from that. But he had an insight into this deep, instinctive, intuitive thing, which the expert may not have. Now, once upon a time, what was a theologian? He had to fight for his worldly permanence and authority. It was always assumed somebody sitting somewhere has the answers. After 1870, he sat on a chair in Rome. Before that, he sat in somewhere or other, wherever theologians sit. Eunomius, Bishop of Cyzicus, says, "I know God better than he knows himself." And God was so busy being God, and Eunomius had time thinking about it. What it'd be to be God. Again, read Job 38:39, where God puts us in our place. So the modern world, which has, through the media, shown us, the Catholic bishops almost all said, "Well, boy, the Pope came out beautifully last year on birth control." Catholic theologians, almost unanimously, "Boy, he really blew it." And the faithful are shook. Well, I wish they'd known for 1,200 years already. Lutherans say councils can err. I don't know why they think the denominational conventions can't. What we find in the modern world is that we each have to create our own world. What do? The expert in the modern world has to keep winning his credentials. He doesn't get it automatically by his caste, we say. He has a charisma or doesn't. It's parceled out. Some things, the local pastor, Bill Coffin's Yellow Pages type guy, will know more about and be better at than any pope or bishop or top theologian or expert. The modern world parcels this out. But once upon a time, that local man had to be equally good at everything. Now you find his expertise is not complete in all these realms. Rapidation, one priest calls it. The pace of change helps us lose confidence in the expert. So, are we worse off? Did we used to worship theologians, perhaps, or systems? I'm in the Missouri Synod. What always is interesting to me is that an awful lot of people in our clergy thought that the people who wrote our books of dogmatics were errorless. Now, they had a doctrine that said they weren't. But if you challenged anything in their books, until I remember a classmate of mine read a paper once in which he showed the disagreements between Carl Ferdinand Wilhelm Walter and Francis Pieper. And it, ordinarily, when Francis Pieper said, "There are those who..." We were told that meant Schleiermacher, Ritschl, Harnack, and all those bad guys. He really meant Walter was wrong. By the way, between the two, Walter was right. Pieper was wrong, if you want to know. But it was a tremendous trauma. The people in the room didn't argue who of them was right. They wanted to condemn my classmate for saying that there could have been a disagreement between these men. Well, that's making an idol out of some very fallible people. The third of these was the breakup of models. The loss of worldly permanence and reliability. Then I ask, if it's not necessary to change, it is necessary not to change. All right. If the parish as we have it, and the denomination as we have it, and the foreign missionary enterprise we have it, and, praise God, the Sunday school as we have it, are the kingdom of God, if they are perfect forms, then it's necessary not to change them. Work hard to keep them as they are. But if it's just possible that there might be better modes of carrying on mission, ministry, and mutual service in the world, then it's necessary really to change. That is, lift everything up and look under the whole thing. We don't really know a lot of what the religious institutions of the future are to look like in this time of a new worldview. You give me a great big chart, and I don't think I could say what it ought to look like tomorrow. I know a lot of things that it should be that it isn't now. Parish is now organized almost entirely along VA-FHA lines, right? The people you worship with are the people who earn $18,450 with you or $8,500 with you, and so you can afford that house. And if you get $1,000 more, you move up to Winnetka, and if you get $1,000 less, you move out to Sylvan Meadow or the more luxurious the name, the lower the level. All right. Wouldn't it make sense if some of the time, at least, we were deeply committed to the people with whom we worked, or like at Holder, the people with whom we have leisure together? This isn't the only thing that ought to go on. We get pretty sick of each other after a few weeks. Maybe after a couple of forums we get pretty sick of each other. But we have a like-mindedness because we are at leisure together and we open our spirits to each other. Wouldn't it be nice if we had to do this with some of the people we worked with or argued with instead of just the people we live next to? Denomination. What earthly good is a denomination? They're going to be around for a long time. But I dare you to work out a rationale and defend it theologically. Sunday school. Do you know anybody who's in the Sunday school business who really believes in it? Again, no. We have to make do because that's the slot the old worldview and the old culture gave us. But anything but that, we would get more through. I have a simple theory that if you did exactly what you did Sunday morning, but did it Wednesday at 3 and let kids come in old clothes, something might happen. But in the present slot, no. All right, if everything is all right. So the institutions aren't all that right. Social action, personal style, celebration, worship. I'm not all that enthralled about every folk, rock, or jazz mass. Tomorrow night we're going to have a beautiful one. Some people around here wrote, and I get to be part of, and so on. I really like it. And then I'll go to another one next week, and another one next week. And then I'll sneak home and play Bach's B minor and, find my thing. I'm not saying they're all that good, but was worship the way we had it all that good? Where you look at the back of somebody else's head and call that worship? Peter Taylor Farsyth, Gothic architecture is the invention of the devil to keep people from hearing the gospel. I think the pew is. The pew is the invention of the devil to keep people from hearing the gospel or from being. What do you do in church? I wrestled with this for years. I was a consultant on architecture and I was doing baptism. If you can't do it Willie Hertzfeld style and really dunk them, Romans 6, we Lutheran make so much of that, and that doesn't make any sense at all if you don't immerse. But since we can't, we have other means. We put a little water on the head, or I predict aerosol spray in the future. Pastor, be sure not to get the gown wet. It's the fourth generation. And boy, did I miss that. I just sloshed all over. I had a reputation for bad aim, but I at least wanted to get noticed. All right. So then we'd say, if you want baptism, that's initiation. Dying with Christ, living with him, joining the community. It ought to be the entrance of the church. People say, well, then how can you speak if you're in the pew up front? If you didn't have pews, you'd just say, well, here's something going to happen. Come on, everybody. That's how it had to be in the early church, where you did it in houses. The Lord's Supper. I go to a church where I think they can squeeze four fairly thin people on each side. And you go up in a long, doleful march. The Eucharist.